This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored in part by TradeStation.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Yellen talks, markets move, the weather is to blame, retail sales plunge, and our guest today, Charles Bitterman from Trim Tabs. All this and much more on episode number 351 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a warm welcome to you if you're joining us for the first time. Welcome aboard. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I am Andrew Horowitz, your host, where we spend some time each and every week talking about markets, economy, all sorts of fun things that involve your money, your investments, and your future. We bring on guests, and today, as I mentioned, we have Charles Bitterman coming on in a little while, talking about some things related to the economy that I have talked to him about in the past, as well as we're going to ask about his new ETF that he has that deals with buybacks and shrinking float in stocks, and it should be pretty interesting. I do want to talk to you about some of the things that happened during the week, some things that are going to be happening in the next week or so coming up. You know, it's a holiday shortened week. Monday, the markets are closed in the U.S. due to President's Day. But we did see some interesting things last week. Well, we saw that Janet Yellen made her first presentation to Congress, made her first speech as the Fed chairperson, and it was pretty much what everybody had thought, although seems that there was a different read on it by markets. You know, she had come across in the beginning, before the final confirmation, as quote-unquote dovish. In other words, she was going to continue on with the very aggressive stimulus that was presented by the prior Fed chief and the Fed overall. And, you know, nobody thought anything different about it. The reality was that, okay, we know that she is rather dovish. We know that she is pretty much really very much in favor of continuing stimulus if it needs be, especially if there's no inflation and if the economy seems to need it. And she spoke. Now, you remember something. What happened here was that the markets came in initially because when her speech text was initially released at 8:30 in the morning, there was no discussion of additional stimulus. There was nothing really different in her presentation. There was nothing that was talked about that would seem that would be different than the course that was currently involved with cutting back about $10 billion per month from the current bond buying program by the Fed, which is now at $65 billion per month. And that would basically fade off into the nether over the next, 6 to 12 months, dependent on economic conditions and the numbers that we see and each and every data point, etc. And then she started to speak to Congress about 10 o'clock, and there was some murmurs and whispers that, oh, she's saying things that are a bit more dovish. There was really nothing said. As a matter of fact, if you look at the market action since the Thursday prior, if you go back about 6 or 7 days in the markets and you just simply look at a daily chart of the S&P 500, what you'll notice is that on that Thursday, there was a upside reversal day, meaning that the markets came in and continued their downtrend, and all of a sudden it stopped, turned up for whatever the reason was, and started moving higher. And that signaled, as it has done in the past, it seems a few times, get back in and do it fast. Because we saw one of the best weeks on the S&P 500 and the Dow and the NASDAQ last week. And really, if you add it all up, while the markets really did behave very, very positively, and you want to call it because of Janet Yellen, I don't think so. If you want to call it because of this upside reversal, more probable. Because each and every data point that we saw during the week didn't add any real incremental benefit that the economy was getting better. And remember something, we saw last week, or the prior week, that Friday, the jobs numbers, which were, they were pretty ugly. I didn't think they were very good. Yeah, we saw a better unemployment rate as we discussed, but there really wasn't a better level of employment going on, the activity when you look at how many people hired, et cetera, and you know, all of the underlying components was not better. Now, the month prior, we did see that that really shook markets. What happened this month? Well, you can make an argument that when you look at each of the data points that came out, the ones that were important last week, the ones that were weak, you could say, well, these do support the idea that the Fed will, in fact, start to slow down on their bond purchase reduction. In other words, they'll kind of continue the current level they have now. Does that mean that's really beneficial to the markets, to the economy? Well, it's beneficial to the idea that there is liquidity in the markets, and that really is the whole bottom line here. We saw retail sales plunge way off where they should have been and where expectations were, even though they were brought down significantly. And why is this? Well, the weather, right? The weather is to blame. There is a big blame game being played right now that every single data point that really does not agree with what expectations were, even though they take into consideration the weather and the problems they're having through the cold and extreme cold with travel, with delivery, with going out and buying things. This is the blame item right now. And what does that mean? Because let's break this down for a second. Well, if we have something that is going on that is short-term and temporary, because we know, at least we think we know, unless something crazy is going to happen, that the weather situation, the idea that we're having this polar vortex, extreme cold weather, problems with airlines, etc., it's all going to end soon. Because, well, we're going to have, eventually we're going to have spring and then summer. And things will get warmer and we won't have these problems. The question, though, is, are we going to see that there is a significant amount of backfilling? Is there going to be consumers going out and actually buying goods that they didn't buy in duplicate? So if they missed certain amounts of product buying in 1 month, they're just going to simply go back, and are they going to buy it the next month in double to make up for the difference? Well, I decided something. I started hearing all about this blame. In fact, if you really look at it, it goes all the way to the Olympics. Did you see what happened with the men's ski? I think it was the men's and the women's, maybe speed skating. The team really wasn't doing well. Matter of fact, they were about 1 second off of where they thought they should be in terms of the one of the races. And they blamed it on the material in their new suits that were being produced by Under Armour. Now, if you go back and look at the story, there's a variety of different manufacturers and developers that were all involved in creating this special suit that was incredibly light, and it was also the supposedly the fastest suit ever. So you had this great ability for the suit to, I guess, deflect and stream with the wind, and all, you know, with be aerodynamic, and just these great things about this suit. But somehow, the Olympic team was slower. So what do they do? Can't be them. It can't be that they suck. Nope, it can't be that. What is it going to be? Blame it on the gear. Yep, that's it. So what did they do? They couldn't take it anymore. So they went and they changed back to the gear that they had when they last did a great run and they had some great times. And they put that on. And guess what happened? They still sucked. So now they're perplexed. What can they blame it on now? Man, it would be terrible to blame it on the truth. The truth is you didn't skate well. You didn't have it. You didn't have what the other people had and the other players had at this point, and you are to blame. So now we have retail sales. Oh, my. The weather's to blame. We have a higher-than-expected initial claims number. Oh, the weather's to blame. You go on and on and on, and what happens here is you start getting this whole cockamamie excuse process going. So I started thinking about it. Do you know what I did? I sent him a credit card bills that were due recently. And I put a note, sorry, they're late. The weather, put a little note on that. The weather is to blame. You know, I'm really sorry. If you next time you get pulled over by a police officer anytime within the next few weeks, say, hey, it's the weather. The weather is a problem. It's terrible. The weather is just really making all these problems with my car. And I got to tell you something, it's the weather. But you know, after a while, when do you get to a point where it's enough? You know, why do we have to have this ridiculous process of trying to blame and find fault and look for excuses when we know that the trend for some of these things has also been falling? Now, Under Armour fell about 2.5% on the news of this. Wow. And it's kind of funny if you think about it. Under Armour fell 2.5%. Yeah, it's been up a lot lately, and they had great earnings numbers recently. And okay, but Under Armour fell on this news that the potential for their suits that they supplied were really not up to par. Now, how many potential suits did they supply to the Olympics, and what does that have to do with the rest of their sales? Well, is it going to be an image issue? Well, maybe. I think that, you know, simply you'll see probably Under Armour pop right back up next week when the markets come back and open up after the holiday. Okay, that's good. But in the end, this is the kind of thing that's going on right now. We're hitting in an area of the market, in the sentiment, and in the cycle of where things are getting so blown out of proportion that each and every thing that goes on, the blame, you know, we had the emerging markets to blame, and that's not going to last forever, although things are not really better there, by the way. Lots of problems still persist in the emerging markets, and I am not yet at a point where I'll say, okay, you know what? The storm has passed, so to speak, in the emerging markets. Is the weather to blame? If the weather's to blame, I got to tell you something. You take all your money right now and you go short natural gas. Because if weather is the only thing that keeps on pushing up natural gas, we do know one thing, as we said before, that the weather will definitely change over the next several months. And if every time there is a discussion that there is going to be another storm and more cold and more problems, and you see natural gas go up, just keep on pounding that on the short side. Now, you would probably think that you're going to find much discussion that's going to start talking about, well, it's not only the weather with natural gas, it's more usage, and it's the stopping of some fracking in certain areas, and it's going to be the demand, etc. This is how the game is played. We look for excuses to go in the direction that we want, and the cumulative we here, and markets will, in fact, just continue to believe things because, well, they want to. And that's the bottom line on what's going on right now. We want to believe that the stimulus that will be provided over the next however long by the Fed is going to be continuing to provide a significant amount of benefit to the economy, when we know, really, at the heart of it, there was incremental benefit each and every time that we had. So QE1, QE2, QE3, every single one of those had reduced benefit overall. Markets are okay, but yet when we look at the facts, we do see that the benefit that was gained from each and every one of them was less and less. Then you have the fact that, well, okay, well, we have this retail sales plunge. Okay, weather, fine, but we can then rationalize. We're real good at that, aren't we? All of us rationalizing. Well, it's because of this, and that's okay. Rationalization is a big part of the overall market psychology. So just think about that. Put that all into a place when you start looking at some of the news that comes out. For example, when we see over the weekend that China's credit, the surge in the loans that were made recently, and you see the rationalization by the media that says, wow, that's going to really support their economy and their expansion and make sure that this 7.5% GDP is going to continue for some time. Then you have to scratch your head and wonder, wait a minute, hold on. There's a ton of bad loans. Shadow banking looks like it is really in seeing some very, very problematic stages right now with the fact that there is bad loans on the books and we're seeing additional amounts of credit problems in China. We see that the government is trying to crack down on the property value increases and the gains that we've seen in all of the regions inside of China over the last several months. So how, in fact, is it that the increase in China credit is actually good? Well, we could say, and I think this is reasonable to say, that while the government has such a tight grip on the amount of money that can be loaned, they've loosened the grip a little bit, and allowed for additional money to be loaned out over the last period because they want to make sure that there is this growth. They want to make sure that there is the continuation of the economic upward movement that they've seen. And, of course, they're a little bit nervous because they've seen a lot of things slow down, like manufacturing, a service index, etc. At the same time, if, in fact, we're seeing that there is all of this incredible amount of bad loans and late payments that are growing and delinquencies, etc., how does this really benefit their economy? Is it the hope that simply we find a long-term benefit to adding more to the same thing that's going on to try to stoke the economy by adding all these loans, particularly that are going to end up in one of two places, probably in the markets and in real estate? We already know that real estate's a problem. We already know that the Chinese markets are seeing a lot of outflows. So, okay, we can go with that a little bit and kind of try to make some beneficial commentary out of that. We're going to get to some of the economics after we talk to our guest today. I also want to talk to you about the boat show. I went to the Miami Boat Show this weekend and talked to you about some of the things I saw. I think from an economic and a global standpoint, there's some very interesting things that go on that went on that I observed that also can be transferred in terms of what is happening to the equity markets in the U.S. Before we do that, I want to talk about TradeStation. You know, they're a great sponsor of ours. And one of the reasons is because they have some of the best charting that I've ever seen. You know, they have great brokerage, no question about that. They have not only brokerage of futures and ETFs and Forex and all that, but it all ties out into, if you'd like to, automated trading strategies that are right on your chart. You can actually trade from your chart. How cool is that? You can actually put in trade orders right on a chart to track where you are. So therefore, when you're looking at a chart and let's say you're using some kind of a feature that maybe is a simple reversal or a island reversal or any other kind of indicator that you like, whether it's simple or it's complex, and you can actually have the trade triggered right from the chart. That's awesome. The other thing that TradeStation has that, you know, you really need to think about this is how do you monitor 20 or 30 or 40 securities utilizing all the different indicators that you may, you know, whether you want a 50-day moving average, you want a MACD crossover, or one of the ones we have at Trigger Charts, I don't know, whatever you're using. Well, they have something called Radar Screen, which is like one cell in a particular time period that you choose that is like a miniature chart that will calculate everything you need, and you can trade right from there, automated trading right from there. And what's great about TradeStation is that when you look at the charts, the clarity, the crispness, I mean, this is something important to me. I want to be able to really hone in exactly when I get zoomed all the way in on really clean data to look at. So that's really great. And you know what? You can get 90 days of free trading. You can get the actual platform and the feeds for free. All you have to do is go take a look. We have the links on the Disciplined Investor website on the show notes. TradeStation I use, everybody in my office uses, pretty much everybody I know uses because of the ease, and they have the trading app store where you can actually install many hundreds of different trading apps and indicators that are done by professionals. You remember a number of weeks ago we talked to Larry Williams. We talked about his indicators. They're available on TradeStation, and you can actually put those right on your charts. And it'll tell you a whole story about what's going on with an index, with the futures, with Forex, with stocks, whatever it may be. Great stuff. Check out TradeStation, all the things they have to offer. I'm sure you'll be glad that you did. Let's get to our guest. And our guest today is Charles Bitterman, and he is the portfolio manager of the Trim Tabs Float Shrink ETF, which is very interesting. We'll talk a little bit about what that actually means and explain what float means and give you an education there. Also, puts out some great statistics in his trim tabs, so we have a good amount of information to talk about. Hey, Charles, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a few years. How you been?
I've been good, thanks. I've been better, I've been worse, you know, I'm fine. Getting older as the days go on. And yourself?
Good. It's foggy here in Sausalito. We're looking out the window watching... hearing the foghorns as the ships go through the Golden Gate.
Nice. I got to put some maybe in the background so we get that effect. Let's talk about some of the things, and let's start off with some things that you're known for, some of your employment numbers and all, and then we'll get into the whole idea of some of the things that are going on in the market with regard to float. I know for a long time you were kind of critical of some of the jobs numbers that came out in terms of how they were reported. You do something different. You do it by the payroll taxes, right?
Yeah, every day, those people with salary jobs, which is what the BLS reports, salary jobs, our employers send whatever is withheld from our paychecks into the Treasury. So the Treasury gets every day withheld income and employment taxes from everybody with a job.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we've asked many, many times, they won't break out that data into like how much is income, how much are employment taxes, how many people. They have all that data, but they don't want to tell anybody. They don't even track it themselves. Instead, they do surveys of 100,000 employers and government agencies with maybe 20% of the workforce. And from that survey, they estimate quarterly numbers, which with it a year later is revised when they get actual data from the states where employers file quarterly for unemployment insurance data. I mean, all that's very confusing and but the bottom line is what the government reports every month is a survey, and the government says it could be 100,000 either way given the reliability of the numbers, but Wall Street trades it like, wow, this is great, this is real. All that being said, the last couple of months, the lousy job number the BLS reports is actually the same lousy job number that we've been seeing, about 100,000 new jobs, because the economy is not really growing. Wage and salary growth is nominally 2% or less year over year. It's down from where it was before. Believe it or not, there was a tax raise beginning of this year where employment taxes were hiked, tax rates were hiked. The equivalent of reducing wage and salary growth from 3% last year to 2% this year.
Hmm. So there's no, that is definitely what we're seeing, is that there's no major growth in terms of wages. And we're seeing that, you know, jobs are settling down a little bit from where they are, but it doesn't seem to really, I don't think anybody's really too concerned about it, because at the same time, we're seeing that the employment number in terms of the employment rate, even with the recent rise in the participation rate is at 6.6%. So not good, by the way. Obviously, the question is, you know, what is the normalized employment number in this new economy, whether it's going to be the old days back to 4, whether 6 is really normal. I don't know if you have any you know, thoughts on that, but it seems to me that a higher number than we had before is a much more normalized level given technology and given the aging workforce and all that. Would you agree with that?
Well, I really think that employment is a function of how difficult it is to start businesses and grow an economy. And so you have headwinds all across the board. Government and regulation is making it harder, not easier, to start a new venture.
Mm-hmm.
So on the margin, if it's more difficult to get something going, or if it's more expensive to get something going, there's going to be less new stuff started. And that's where the growth happens, on the margin. So, you know, you're not seeing the preconditions are not here for a rapidly growing economy. There's no technological breakthrough, the equivalent of broadband, which boosted growth in the early 2000s, or the Internet in the 1990s. So we have no technological breakthrough. We have government impediments to growth. And so we have a stagnant economy, and we have a buoyant stock market. Isn't that logical connection between the two?
Something's missing to me, and I'm almost at a point of saying, you know, do I just say, who cares? Because, you know, you start...
Well, most investors are saying that, who cares? Let's stay fully invested. The Federal Reserve will take care of us. They're sugar daddies. They're our sugar daddy.
How long... Is this the longest... I've been thinking about this the last few days. Is this the longest time that we've seen, or longest period of intervention, do you know, that we've seen...
I don't think I've ever seen anything like, there's never been any intervention like this before.
Right. Yes.
You know, it is like the Fed pats itself on the back that they've been doing all this without it creating any inflation, and that, you know, goods inflation is, but what they've been doing is they've been inflating the amount of money available to buy financial assets.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've been inflating the cash, creating new cash, as a result, they're a bank, and any bank can give you, a depositor, instant cash by just crediting your account. as long as the rules allow it, and the Fed can do that. So they're buying bonds, creating money to do so. The sellers of the bonds get that cash, and that cash enters the mainstream of money available to buy financial securities.
Right.
So it inflates the money supply, and that inflates asset prices. So, yes, we are having inflation. No, it's not of goods, services, rents. It's of assets.
Yeah, but commodities aren't going up as much, or they haven't been. So when you look at that, you look at the official inflation numbers that are used to provide the statistics, you don't see it. So it's just kind of like, hey, prices are going up in certain things, but not the ones that we're counting.
Well, yeah, it's a self, you know, the current executives of our financial system and the people running things, they have a short shelf life. You know, they can do things expeditiously to make it look good. It sounds good. I mean, heck, they've, you know, history is not going to be kind to those of us who ignored the reality and accepted current market valuations as logical.
Right, but it's not going to be good for you either if you seemingly fight that and try to think on a level of, okay, historically it should be this or that, and when I look at this, but you know, at the same, you know, almost look at, for example, look at a Twitter. Now, you know, Twitter has all the makings and all the aspects of not so much a .com, but an overvaluation to a level that's really unbelievable. But yet people are pairing that and looking at it as a Facebook, which it is not. It's a whole different discussion. Now, they come out with a comment that, hey, we're going to try to make these new profile pages that are like Facebook. Like, so what? You know, I'm going to call my company Facebook. That doesn't mean I'm Facebook. And you know, people are just buying into this and going along with it. And it's not just the retail investors. It's also the institutions, because you can see the amount of money that's coming into these things. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't let it drop. But,
yes.
You know, that goes along, right along, by the way, with the discussion of float, because the prime example and probably the poster child for a shrinkage of float has got to be IBM, right?
Well, IBM and lots of companies, lots of tech companies. Our portfolio, my fund that invests in companies reducing the number of shares outstanding or shrinking the float, is full of a lot of tech companies are in there.
Mm-hmm.
They're growing cash like IBM, you know, and well, not, I don't know if IBM is in. I don't think they're in. Oracle is, Apple is, where they're growing free cash flow and using some of that free cash flow to reduce the number of shares outstanding. So let me start again. Maybe some people don't know. I have started in October of 2011 an exchange-traded fund called TrimTab's Flow Shrink ETF. TTFS is the ticker symbol, and it embodies our investment style, which is follow what the house does if you want to beat the market. Mm-hmm. The house being the public companies. It's their shares that are traded. They know a lot more than you or me or any analyst what's really going on. And so what we've discovered over the years, if they like what's happening in their company, everything else being equal, they'll reduce the number of shares. And if they don't like what's going on, they'll sell more shares.
Mm-hmm.
And so we look at the entire market, and we segregate out the top 100 companies that are reducing the number of shares, only growing and only using free cash flow to reduce the number of shares, and they're also the debt equity ratio is not increasing.
Right.
So these are companies using a portion of their cash to reduce the extra cash. And what we've discovered is that not only does the market reward those companies with, like, if they reduce the number of shares 6%, the price of the remaining shares should go up by 6% to say that the company's total value shouldn't go down simply because they reduced the number of shares using extra cash.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really happening is discovering these companies are getting a premium from the market. So, for example, in 2013, our fund was up 44%. The S&P, including dividends, was up 32%. And so the average company shrunk its float by 6%. So the outperformance, 6% was float shrink, and the other 6% was a premium.
Right.
And so we're up over 80% since we launched, and a half of that is float shrink, half of that is premium.
Now, it's interesting that the float shrink part of it, which I find fascinating, because it does a couple of things. I mean, on one hand, I would agree with you that a company that feels that they're going to do better thinks that, hey, the best opportunity to buy shares is what we know, and it's our company. We're going to buy back shares because we think they're going to really outperform. And at the same time, because of this, we get an artificial boost to our EPS, and that's what I was talking about with IBM. IBM seems to be selling off a lot of parts of their business. IBM seems to be continuing on a process of buying back shares at an extraordinary rate, allowing them to keep their earnings growing. Yet in the only thing that I see from IBM, generally speaking, is not an expansion of the business, not new technologies, not any kind of innovation, but rather financial engineering to keep their EPS going. And the question I have with that, if that's the case, how long can that actually last? Can it go on forever?
Until they go private.
Right.
You know, there are two ways, you know, I totally consider a radical theory that earnings don't matter and all there is in the stock market are shares of stock. And then there's money that goes in and out of the checking accounts of stock market intermediaries.
Mm-hmm.
Since intermediaries, 80% of the S&P 500 is owned by institutions.
Right.
These days. Mm-hmm. So if a company like IBM, now also consider that the people who run public companies make more money on their shareholdings than in salaries.
Mm-hmm.
And that their real wealth is in their shareholdings, not their salaries.
Right.
So if they could, whether it's financial engineering or not, if they're growing cash and can use the cash to reduce the number of shares, then their net worth will go up.
Right. No, I agree with you. I mean,
the question is, are they growing the cash or are they borrowing? Companies that borrow the cash to shrink the float historically don't do well.
But historically, the reference that you're using is a much higher interest rate than we have currently. I mean, right now, we're in ridiculously low interest rates.
But still, companies that borrow to buy do not do well.
Okay, I got you.
There is something there about, whether if you're using the benefit of the surplus cash, it's a different dynamic for a company. You know, that you're increasing your leverage when you're borrowing to shrink the float. Even if the interest rate is low, you still have that debt.
Right, exactly. But then the other one is you have a cleaner balance sheet, and you have less shares outstanding. And I guess also that gives them a little bit of a cushion, because in the time when, let's say, things are going really well and they bought back a lot of shares over time and that worked out well for them, and if they want to at any given point to then raise their cash, and let's say that's a good time for their stock, they could actually then do an offering and raise cash at a pretty good time when their stock is high, and if things roll over,
But just consider that it could be said that the purpose of a public company is to grow free cash.
Okay, I got you.
You know, as opposed to revenues, earnings, and all that other stuff, the ultimate reward is how much cash is being generated by this enterprise over time.
Right.
Now, you could say Amazon is not generating any cash, and it's using up all its cash flow to grow. But, you could also consider that an investment in the future and in increasing its market share of total retailing that eventually will be hugely profitable in terms of cash flow.
Right. It's interesting. So it's kind of a fascinating, a dimension of what has gone on over the last few years in terms of the continuation of stock buybacks, which when you see them, you often see them accompanying, let's say, earnings announcements that maybe don't do that well, and maybe they missed a little bit, or maybe their outlook isn't as good, and that the stock buyback definitely helps the buoyancy of
It also helps the supply and demand characteristics.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I agree.
Apple bought back a huge amount of shares, and it supported its stock price.
Right, exactly. Which is, I talked about that the other day. And what was interesting about the Apple deal was, I don't think I recall a time when Apple was vocal about, publicly vocal about, I was surprised about the share move, like Tim Cook was. And then they actively went in and bought back shares and made it very clear to the public. Now, maybe that's because of Icon, but,
Your site is, you are the disciplined investor.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
And to me, what I tell people to do, if you're... you know, I think the market's overvalued here, and it's inflated because of the Fed's actions. But underneath, we have a vibrant, growing economy globally.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a disciplined investor, what I do is I buy on a regular basis, dollar cost averaging, in essence, my own fund. And I also, you know, go short the emerging markets and other stuff as I see fit. But for a discipline, there's no better discipline than dollar cost averaging, as you well know.
Yeah, over time.
And dollar cost averaging into a fund that only invests in companies growing cash and using a full portion of that cash, you know, has been an alpha jetter over the existing market, where you get extra return and in the past, while we haven't had a major down market, in the past we outperform on the downside in down markets, and the reason why is at least the companies are buying back their shares. If in a down market, the basic definition of a bear market is where there's more shares chasing less money.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So this is the symbol on this particular fund is
TTFS.
TTFS, and I think it's kind of interesting how it's a bit different than your basic, oh, we buy the S&P 500. Period, end of sentence, obviously. There's a lot more depth to this. Now, let's kind of skip over for a second and go back to the economic data out there. Is there anything else that you could bring to us that may enlighten us in terms of the economies and what's going on?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was intrigued to notice that the Census Bureau reported advanced retail sales, which is a pretty bad number.
Mm-hmm.
Today, showing contraction, and historically, that number historically has been based on a survey of only a few thousand retailers out of a million retailers. So, I've always thought that survey was questionable. But I've been hearing from people at MasterCard that the government is now, and I've been hectoring them for not using real, that they are now starting to work with MasterCard and using more real-time data.
Mm-hmm.
And so MasterCard people said that the government's data for December was pretty close to theirs. And so the December and January retail sales numbers, which are pretty awful, are correlate with what we're seeing for the overall economy, which is an economy where jobs are growing at roughly 100,000 a month. And the only reason there are that many jobs grow is most of those jobs are low paying, much lower paying than the prior jobs that the existing employees are getting. What I'm saying is that the economy is not growing sustainably. We have an administration that's making it more difficult for growth to occur, given all the rules, all the regulations, all the hassles, and the higher costs. And things are, you know, we have to alter the overall environment to make it more positive for business in order to get back on a sustainable growth path.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, when you look at the sales numbers, which were pretty awful, you know, we have, of course, we have just a good way of rationalizing a lot of time. You know, the fact of the matter is that we saw that a lot of that was blamed on the lousy weather. Now, whether or not the consumers come back in and they'll actually stock up double.
Yeah, but the weather stuff is a red herring.
Of course.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics said that in this January, there were about 200,000 job days impacted by the weather, and that's compared to an average of 400,000. So, yes, there was bad weather, but it was less than typical countrywide. I mean, it was more concentrated, but the actual impact. So, you know, it's like the bulls are saying, yeah, it's the problem is the weather, things are fine.
Right.
You know, get fully invested here, folks.
That's what they say, and it's really kind of interesting how, we're having the continue. I have a question for you. This is interesting. So, generally, this is a general question here now. You know, we've been seeing this very interesting pattern that you may have some news that comes out overnight or in Asia or in emerging markets and wherever it may be, and, you know, you see that futures kind of come in a bit, markets open. As soon as that 9:30 bell rings, it's off to the races. I mean, gigantic movement in the indices at that point, and rarely is it a downstroke, because any downstroke is caught with some buying activity. What is it at that 9:30. My opinion is it's the excess accumulation of retail that is being deployed.
No, it's financial. It's money going into financial assets. Look, there's where's the government has been. They're only adding $60 billion a month now,
mm-hmm.
compared to $80 billion a month 2 months ago. But that's still a huge amount of money, and companies are still shrinking the float, and they're still buying back shares. So the supply. Yeah, there's this huge amount of money there, but if you look at it, it's all index.
Right, exactly.
So that's institutions. It's not individuals. Individuals aren't buying the SPY.
So, but why are they waiting? Why are they waiting until 9:30?
Because of volume. I mean, that's just the way they do it. It's like before that, you're buying futures anyway.
Right.
So they're buying this. They're buying the ETF.
Aha. Uh-huh. Interesting. So then they get the buying begets buying regardless of things and. Makes it look like it's not as bad as it is and covers
it
up.
If you actually look at it, the volume is heavier on down days.
Of course, much heavier.
So people are actually selling and typically what you're seeing is buying generated by positive flows. Government's creating money, and that money has to go somewhere, and it's inflating prices.
I mean, so
we're having asset price inflation. You know, it's a misnomer to say there's no inflation. There's a lot of inflation. It's in asset prices. It's not in goods. It's not in milk. It's not in rent. It's in stocks.
Yeah, that's what the whole wealth effect is all about. But anyway, listen, Charles Bitterman, again, he's the portfolio manager of the TrimTabs Float Shrink ETF, and you can take a look at that with the symbol TTFS. Well, great stuff, and I appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. Oh, sorry about that. It was daydreaming. It must have been the weather. Definitely the weather. Sorry, I wasn't totally in focus there. The weather had me a little bit screwed up, you know? Let's talk about the boat show a little bit. Why don't we? So I went down the Miami Boat Show, which is probably one of the biggest ones in the world, one of the best ones, and I talked with some of the vendors, spent a little time on some of those big old boats, I mean those really big boats, and went around, looked at some of the really cool things, you know, some of the things you find are these great, if you've ever been to a boat show, they have some fun things there. They had this guy doing like cleaning of a car hood. And he put this one little spritz on, a little spritz of this other stuff, a little rubbing, a little buffing, voila. Totally water resistant, amazing color, brought it back from like near death, this particular sun bleached hood. They took some jewelry and he put a little spritz of this little rag he had kind of thing and he schmitzed it all around. The jewelry went from like brass to gold. Amazing. So, of course, we had to buy it. And there was It was the German glue, the magic glue. A guy who was standing there, and he takes like a ceramic, and he cracks it with a hammer, and he then takes a little bit of glue on one side, a little bit of the hardener on the other side, puts it together. Voila! This thing is like back to, I mean, right in front of you. You're watching this, and you're like, unbelievable. He takes a couple of bolts, and he puts a little glue on each side, and he bolts it together, and honestly, within half a second, not even, this thing is bolted together and glued together. You can't get it off. It's ridiculous. So we had to buy some of that. And we go on and find all these fun things to buy. But one of the things I noticed was when we went down, there was three or four different venues. So they have the boat show in the Miami Beach Convention Center. And then they have, that's inside and there's some outside there. Then they have the Strictly Sale, which is down off of Washington and, Fifth, I believe it was, and in South Beach. And there's only sailboats there. Then they had over by the Fountain Blue, that whole entire Collins Avenue area. There was just boats after boats after boats. These very large and incredible boats and some smaller ones, but beautiful. There was one particular boat that was very interesting. It was it had these really high gunnels, and not getting too in-depth here, but these high gunnels and very open area, about 32, 33 feet, a couple of very large engines in it. And it was kind of like this boat for cruising, just very simple, cruising up and down the Miami Bay and things like that. 32 feet, it was like $650,000. I was shocked. Went on some of the Vikings. They have some great sport fish. And here's a story I want to tell you. So we went on these boats, and they were new. So we went on, and I've seen these before, and you know my son likes to take a look at what's going on with these and all the different features they have. So we went on the 60-foot, which is a rather sizable boat, 60-foot brand-new Viking sport fish. And we looked at it and went down and checked out the cabins and the engines and all the good things about it. I think it was close to about $3.5 or $4 million, which was shocking. I mean, I think the 70-foot was about $5.5 million. Of the 12 boats that were right there in that area, in the water, this is in water, by the way, in water, of all the Vikings, probably 4 of them were already sold. Now, this was on Saturday. Now, a couple of them were sold at prior shows, and a couple of them were sold somewhere else, but there was others that were being sold as we were there. We couldn't get up to the flybridge because they were being sold. There was a contract being laid on them right there. At these prices. Now we went on some of the other ones, like the 120-footers and, you know, the real beautiful cruising vessels. And they were a lot cheaper. There was actually one that was about 80 feet that was $650. We were thinking about buying it right there compared to all the other prices that were being shown. But what's interesting and what this tells me, what's going on, and I asked about this specifically, was who's buying and why are they buying and what's going on? How is the boat show doing? How are your sales doing? I want to know. It's a really good read on what's happening. So as it turns out, sales, they tell me, have been pretty good. They say it's been a reasonable year so far, you know, and back last year, of course. And I asked them who was buying, and they said, well, we're seeing a lot of foreigners taking in money to buy boats. A lot of Latin America, tremendous amount of Latin America buying boats. Now, you have to think that that's obvious because we're in Miami. And we're so close to Latin America here. It's probably one of the closest boat shows you're going to get. Maybe something going on. Texas is not as close, really. But Miami is really a big hub for Latin America. And what they're doing is a lot of them want to take money out of their country. And they're finding apartments and they're finding things like boats to actually put their money in. Something tangible that they can have and that they can potentially sell very easily. Or at least they can sell. They have something to sell. Because what's happening is as money leaves, it's always looking for a home. And they can find that if they buy, let's say, a boat, then they can maybe sell to someone else who's having their money leave. And then they have money available in the U.S., etc. So a lot of the movement is because they want out of their current currency and into U.S.-based assets. Now, obviously, we're talking big money here. You don't just take a few bucks. You're talking big money. So it's very interesting. I found that if you think about that in a way, there's some correlation to what's going on in the housing market here in South Florida and also in the boat sales that we just saw and the equity markets, right? Because what you're seeing is that as money is wanting to leave certain areas, and I'm focusing on Latin America right now, but leave Latin America. It's got to find a home somewhere. Yeah, it could go in their mattress, in their wallet, somewhere, but still it's got to get out of the country if that's what their intent is. So where does it go? Well, it goes to the U.S. And that's, I think, why we're seeing such a substantial build in the equity markets in the face of all the negative things that have been happening, like the really negative economics that have been going on, at least the much lower economics, even with the blame game going on. Now, let's talk about some of the things that are happening in the economics coming up. So next week, again, on Monday, the markets are closed. But on Tuesday, we have Empire Manufacturing, somewhat important. We have long-term tick flows. In other words, how much money is being put into treasuries by countries outside of the U.S., we have the housing market index that's happening also on the 18th. Now, on the 19th, we have PPI. This is going to be important because the question is going to be, is there any inflation that's going on? So on the 19th, we have PPI, the producer price index, and then on the 20th, we have the CPI. Right sandwiched smack in the middle of those is on the 19th at 2 o'clock, we have the Fed releasing their minutes from the January 28th and 29th FOMC meeting. So we got the PPI coming out, we got the Fed releasing minutes, and we got the CPI the next day. The big issue right now is really going to be focused on, is there going to be any surprise in the CPI? Right now, I don't think anybody really thinks there's going to be a substantial amount of increase in the rate of inflation, at least temporarily, even though we are seeing gold hit 1,300, right? We saw that last week. And you're seeing there's a lot of money. Bets on gold have been higher on the future side than we've seen in a very long time. And hedge fund managers are really piling into gold. And you have to wonder, how does that all relate? You know, you have a market that's going up. You have economics that are getting worse. You have a dollar that's going down. You have gold that's going up. You have oil that's going up. And you have bonds that are going nowhere. Which one of those doesn't belong? I don't know. Maybe they're all right. They are all right because this is what they did. But the question has to be, and it has to be posed, of course. Something's a little out of whack here. We have initial jobless claims on the 20th. And really, the rest of the week, we have, I think, the most important thing is going to be the Philly Fed outlook. We saw a 9 on the last 8 looking for on this particular release. Then we have the leading index coming out on the 20th, looking for a pretty reasonable level of movement there. Nothing major, 0.4. And then we have the existing home sales coming out, looking for about 4.6 versus 4.8 print last. And also, that's going to be about a 4.5% reduction in the existing home sales. And they're going to blame that on, don't tell anybody, but the weather. The weather. So, you know, so if we have a bad number, weather. Kind of fun. I find it funny, at least. All right, let's see. What else do we have to talk about? We talked about the economics, the weather. We talked about retail sales. There's some earnings still coming out. We've had about a little more than half of the S&P 500 report earnings, and there's still a bunch flowing in. We're going to see what happens, actually, with companies that have really been kicking it up pretty well with the lack of significant amount of fundamentals. For example, I'll talk about Twitter, obviously, picking up again after the earnings, after that big slam down that happened. Facebook keeps on rocking. LinkedIn took a real nosedive and then starting to climb up again. Tesla. Interesting. At the boat show, you know what I saw? I saw these. They're pretty ugly. But these green engines, one of the things that's happening, I think it was about 155 horsepower electric engine that was being displayed. And there was a boat line that was eco-friendly boat line that was based on electric. Now, actually, if you think about it for a second, the same thing happens with automobiles, whereas you have a release of the negative, I guess it would be the outflows of the remains of the carbon, you know, when you burn oil, et cetera, that goes into the environment. And the same thing happens in boating. But in boating, it's twice, really, in a way. Because boating, oftentimes you get the exhaust that goes down into the water, pollutes the water, and then it also then floats up and releases out to the atmosphere as well. It may be a little bit less in the atmosphere in a way, but yet at the same time, there is, I think, a less of an emissions issue in terms of oversight. So in other words, there's worse emissions out of boating than there is out of automobiles. But there seems to be something happening where they're looking at this whole relationship a little closer, especially with boating, of solar and electric. So take a look at Solar City, which is, of course, Elon Musk's company, because he is obviously trying his best to marry the idea of solar and the electric car. And the other thing was about Tesla. There was a fascinating story out, which John Dvorak sent me this weekend, that talked about the credits, the energy credits that were being used, or the clean energy credits that were being used, and that Tesla basically makes about $30,000 $35,000 per car due to the fact that other companies are required to buy from them these credits because they don't have enough electric, or they have too much of the regular non-electric cars, and they're forced to buy these electric credits for companies that only that have the surplus. And of course, every single car that Tesla makes is all for these credits. You know, get these credits for it because it's all they sell, and they can sell those to the other companies. So before the car even goes out the door, frankly, even before it's bought, they generate these credits, and by doing so, they make a heap of money. The question is going to be whether or not this is going to be turned around a little bit and there's going to be some adjustment there, or if other companies come out with their own vehicles, like they're trying to do their best, to offset some of the energy credits that are being paid to other places. So therefore, there is, in a way right now, a significant amount of tailwind to Tesla's earnings or there has been, in terms of their revenue source, because they get it from a variety of sources, very smart, as compared to maybe some of the other companies like GM or Ford who don't have this excess availability of these credits. So it's kind of a freebie for Tesla. Watch the news on this and watch how this actually plays out. I don't know where it's going. A lot of things can happen. The fact is that there can be petitions, there can be changes, there can be nothing. So Tesla may continue to do so. I mean, I think over time, what you'll find is that the amount of money they're getting per car is actually dropped, and the total amount of money they get does come down significantly because the other car manufacturers are figuring out the fact that they don't want to pay this. They're not interested. So, you know, obviously it's hurting their earnings, and they're going to do what they can to come up with alternatives in whatever manner is possible, whether it's electric or natural gas or other kinds of, I don't know, other kinds of wind powered, something they're going to come up with that they can actually utilize the credits internally and buy and sell them internally to do what they can for their own particular, their bottom line. So keep a watch on that. Keep a watch of the next earnings when Tesla comes out and they talk about what their revenues were, what their earnings are. Don't forget they had a couple of one-time levels of income that would not be seen again that we talked about. But yet the stock is still at 200. A lot of optimism, a lot of hope, a lot of feeling that there's a real good opportunity moving forward here. But yeah, I'm not really denying that. I'm not saying anything negative about it. I think actually Tesla has some great opportunity. But I would look at the fundamentals of some of these and some of the other companies out there that have been showing extraordinary amount of attraction for money, yet at the same time, some of the fundamentals don't match up. One of the things I did notice that is going on is that the nutrition and good for you foods, you know, so like the Whole Foods, General Nutrition, the Vitamin Shoppe, they really have been having a hard time. Their earnings have missed. Their outlook is being guided lower, and the stocks have been hit pretty well. Whole Foods in particular got hit twice. The last two quarters really have been pretty negative for them. Just keep a watch on some of the grocers, which have really been having some difficulty, and that's with the fact that there really hasn't been a lot of food inflation to speak of. So the margins are being cut, and aside from the fact that, of course, we have to blame the weather for that, moving that aside, the question is, it was also last quarter that a lot of them had some difficulty as well. Keep a watch at the trends, and if there are sectors that are, in fact, starting to see some kind of a continuation of a move in one direction or the other in terms of their growth, in terms of their revenues, in terms of their margin. So watch those three things and see if there's any kind of consistency moving along, moving the blame aside, to see if there's anything that can tell you that things are getting better, things are getting worse, or staying the same. And I think that'll be very helpful moving through the next couple of quarters. Well, thanks a lot for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week. Any questions, send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.